Good afternoon, and welcome to today's Deloitte Fireside Chat, looking at the role of the auditor, and broadcast live on www.sechistorical.org. I am Mark Peacher, Deloitte & Touche Professor of Accountancy, College of Business, the University of Illinois in Champaign, and moderator for today's program. The Deloitte Fireside Chats are made possible through a partnership between Deloitte LLP and the SEC Historical Society. Deloitte is the brand under which tens of thousands of dedicated professionals and independent firms throughout the world collaborate to provide audit, consulting, financial advisory, risk management, and tax services to selected clients. Through its unique virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org, the SEC Historical Society shares, preserves, and advances knowledge of the history of financial regulation from the 20th century to the present. The virtual museum and archive is free and accessible worldwide at all times, and currently welcomes more than 300,000 visitors annually. Both the museum and the society are independent of and separate from the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and receive no funding from the public sector. The Society is grateful for the sustained and generous support of Deloitte LLP in making the Deloitte Fireside Chats possible. The Deloitte Fireside Chats debuted on www.sechistorical.org in 2009 as interactive programs on current issues in financial regulation of interest to the accounting and auditing professions. Past programs have addressed the role of professional judgment, principles versus rule-based accounting and auditing standards, regulation in the audit profession, and responsibility for preventing and detecting financial reporting fraud. All of these programs can be accessed at any time in the Deloitte Fireside Chat section under Programs in the Virtual Museum and Archive. Joining with me today to look at the role of the auditor are Robert J. Kippers, Deloitte CEO of Deloitte LLP, and a trustee and president-elect of the SEC Historical Society, and Robert E. Moritz, chairman and senior partner of PricewaterhouseCoopers LLP. Before we begin our discussion, I would like to state that the views of the presenters are their own and do not reflect those of Deloitte LLP or of the SEC Historical Society. The Society selected me to moderate the program. I have worked with the presenters to determine the topics and questions that will guide the content of our discussion. The format of the chats invites audiences to submit questions for the program prior to the broadcast, and I will be adding those questions received for today's chat. Well, let me begin by asking Bob Kippers, and I will be using first and last names today for clarity, the following. Bob, what has been the historical value proposition offered by the financial statement audit and by the financial statement auditor within the financial reporting supply chain?
Thanks, Mark. Fundamentally, if you look back, the world didn't really begin in 1933, but we kind of pretend it did because it's indeed more than 75 years ago. But fundamentally, the independent auditor's overriding goal is to contribute to investor confidence by providing reasonable assurance of the fair presentation of a company's financial statements. Many of us believe that the financial statements themselves and the derivative information is sort of the bedrock of the functioning of the capital markets, just because it's so foundational to understanding a company's balance sheet and income statement. It's foundational to understanding a company's operations and its status as of a point in time. Essentially, that role has not changed in those 75-plus years. At the end of our work, we issue a singular report that accompanies the financial statements. We consent to its use when the client files with the SEC. But if you really think about what the auditor does, part of it comes from our attributes and part of it comes from our activity. In terms of attributes, we're independent, disinterested, professionally skeptical. That means we approach our work consistently with a questioning mindset. We have to fundamentally obtain, evaluate, and conclude as to whether or not we are satisfied through the gathering of sufficient competent evidential matter to reach a professional conclusion about the financial statements overall at the end of the day, but elements of that as we go about our work. Our work includes inspection, confirmation, physical examination of evidence, things like, you know, personally observing the inventory process that the company undertakes if they're that kind of company. But we have a lot of decisions to make. The scoping of our work, the timing, nature, and extent of our tests are based on our experience, on professional judgment about the related risks that we have to plan around and execute around. And at the end of the day, we often call on people outside the audit team with expertise. So the end of that process is a report that we like to believe does meet that overriding goal of contributing to investor confidence in the financial statements.
Oh, thank you, Bob. And let me turn it over to Bob Moritz for a second question, a related question. Are stakeholders today confident that these historic value propositions will have sufficient continued value relevance? And Bob, if you would, please address both the audit process and auditor characteristics. And I ask in part because I frequently, perhaps too frequently, hear that the audit has now become little more than a commodity.
Well, thanks, Mark. Let me jump in here and reiterate what Bob Kipper said, which is, again, our goal and the value proposition we bring is that we are independently assessing whether the financial statements are in accordance with GAAP and providing reasonable assurance around that. And for public companies with certain materiality thresholds, they are doing so in an environment that is appropriately controlled. If you ask our stakeholders today, of which there are many, I would tell you that they would respond in saying, first, there is value coming from that independent objective assessment for the financial statements. I think in your question, though, you ask specifically, is there continued value relevance? And now you go to the issue around the expectations gap. And in that regard, you have to think about, one, is what we are attesting to in the financial reporting supply chain, what exactly the investors and other business partners, stakeholders, et cetera, relying on in terms of making their business decisions around either capital investment or partnerships or other aspects associated with them. So I think as we look at this today, when we sit down and talk to the combination of investors, board members, management team members, regulators, stakeholders, banks, creditors, and the like, I think they do see value. The question is, when you look at the changing financial reporting model, the supply chain, so to speak, that's changed a lot over the last number of years. It's changed when you get continuous information now coming out of 8Ks, press releases, and the like. It comes out with who ultimately is an investor and what are they relying on to make their investing decisions. So I think before we get into the role of the auditor, you do have to ask yourself the question, what is the information that people, broadly defined, are relying on when making various decisions and whether they take and need an independent objective view as to whether there's credibility of that information. And that's, as we've traveled around, seems to be what I'll call the root cause issue. Now, to your second question, I think when you look at the audit process and the auditor characteristics that are embedded in not only what Bob Kipper started off with in terms of us being independent, objective, and the like, and bringing forth a series of processes to gather sufficient evidence to come to those conclusions, those today work very well. Obviously, there's a number of issues today saying, you know, whether or not the independence and objectivity is at a sufficient level, which is something that, as we know, the PCAOB is looking at today and will be of some debate over the next couple of months, no different than what's going on in Europe right now. But I would say that, again, the characteristics of the auditor is viewed by the stakeholder group as well-suited for the role as defined today, and second, that the processes we put in place are well-suited for the expectations we have today as defined. But now the question is, what should be that role going forward? What should be the report and a mechanism for providing the information to those stakeholder groups? And I think that's the better and more informative debate that we are having over the next couple months that I know we'll get into in a few minutes.
All right, very good. I'd like to switch gears just a little bit and broaden the lens. In the title of today's Fireside Chat, I would allude to the financial reporting supply chain, not just the auditor, which we have primarily been discussing, the historic and contemporaneous role of the auditor. I might turn this to Bob Kippers and ask you to briefly lay out the major players in the corporate remodel, corporate reporting model today and their roles.
Well, sure. And actually, that's a perfect place to go. Obviously, Bob Moritz and Bob Kippers are, you know, thinking first and foremost of the role our firms play and our professionals perform. But we obviously can't do it alone. I think of it as sort of four key players in order to get a set of financial statements prepared, audited, and out the door, if you will. Management, first and foremost, they have the primary responsibility for preparation of the financial statements, and more specifically, financial management, CFO, chief accounting officer, controller, and all the rest of their folks. Internal audit, and I recognize that internal audit function is not required by rule or otherwise, but most major companies have a pretty extensive internal audit group. The external auditor, which is what we've been discussing so far, and in fact the audit committee. And I've often used an analogy to discuss how those groups working together can have a great outcome and what happens sometimes when they aren't working so well. So I analogize by saying, you know, think of each of those four players as principals in a string quartet. Everyone's playing a part, but it's unique and it's distinctive. And when everything's in tune and in sync, music is truly made. When people are playing at their own tempo, we're not listening to one another, all you're going to get is a bunch of noise. And so they're complementary, but they're unique. Management's a preparer. Internal audit can do an incredible amount of work at behest of the audit committee to make sure controls work is properly done or other issues. The external auditor I've already talked about a little bit. And this is all done under the oversight of the Independent Audit Committee, which is made up today solely of independent directors who are members of the company's board of directors. So I guess when things go wrong, and things do sometimes, and you sort of analyze, you look back with hindsight and say, what happened? It's often the case that one or more of those four principal players did not pay attention or did not execute their responsibilities to an appropriate degree.
Well, I like that analogy. Most string quartets, to be very good, need to have practiced together for a long time. What I'd like to do right now, though, is focus on a highly relevant topical issue. And I guess I'll turn first to Bob Moritz for this. And I would say that, Bob, clearly there are some doubts today regarding the continued ability of the current auditor reporting model to be value-added, to be a value-added part of the financial reporting supply chain. Critics argue that the pass-fail auditor report provides no insight about the experience and know-how of particular auditors who conducted the audit, or about the nature of the specific audit completed. For example, very little clues about materiality thresholds, and very little to no information about close calls in the auditor's assessment of the reasonableness of management's accounting estimates. Now, the PCAOB has been looking at this issue, of course, and its comment period for its concept release on this auditor's reporting model just closed. But Bob Moritz, can you summarize the options being looked at and at how and why these various options could add value or perhaps have unintended consequences?
Yeah, sure, Mark. Let me first off make a couple of comments on the PCAOB's process and its efforts. We collectively, the profession, applaud the efforts that the PCAOB is putting forth in this area for two reasons. Number one, it goes to the issue of ensuring the relevancy of the profession. And anytime we look at an improvement in that relevancy, we believe that's a good thing. Second, what the PCAOB has done with its concept release is asked for input from all stakeholders. And again, as Bob Kippers talked about, there are a number of stakeholders in the corporate reporting supply chain, And all of them have points of view, multiple points of view, around their perspective of the going forward relevancy and value of the auditor in the reporting supply chain. So what the PCAOB has done is put forth a few options for possible change to the today's auditor report. What it does is say whether or not we should think about expanding the current auditor's report and providing, for example, more explanatory paragraphs, matters of emphasis, so to speak, is one option, which would allow for the auditor to provide more insight around some difficult areas, Mark, as you alluded to, in terms of where perhaps there were close calls or judgments made, both from management's perspective and our views on that, or our perspective relevant to, for example, scope of the audit, in terms of maybe a risk assessment of how we might have thought about a particular area or two. The second thing that they have put on the table as an option is, should the auditors do something similar to what management does today, which is what I'll call an ADA or auditor's discussion and analysis, which is now allowing us, the auditing profession, to move from a role of attesting to financial information or other disclosures, et cetera, to one of asserting. He would, in essence, call the auditors out and ask them to put forth their point of view rather than attest to management's point of view. And the other option that they put forth is whether or not our current audit report should be expanded to include either some or all elements of the management MD&A, which today is excluded from the set of financials as we would define them. All of these have pros and cons to them. When you look, obviously, on any one of these, they really get to the issue of, will this further satisfy the need of investors for additional information that they believe the auditors are privy to, that they are not getting in today's form of the audit report, or that other stakeholders are not providing for them? Because, again, as Bob Kippers talked about earlier, we do have a number of stakeholders when you think about the role of management, the board, audit committee, and then ultimately the auditors. So I think there's an option here to enhance the value and relevancy of the auditor in the eyes of investors or other people that have put forth these proposals. And again, there's pros and cons to each of them. And the question that you have to debate today is it enough to further satisfy the needs today, or are there other things that should be thought about differently? I think one of the challenges, and you asked about unintended consequences that we need to be careful of, is, at least from my own personal point of view, we need to be smart about changing the role of auditor as defined today from a body that attests to a management assertion, either over a set of financials or the control environment that they ultimately are providing, to one of being an asserter, providing new or different information above and beyond. That has the potential, which obviously has to be debated, of changing the relationship that auditors have, for example, with audit committee members, or auditors today have with management. All, of course, we want to remain independent, objective, and bring the right level of skepticism around providing an attestation report in some form or shape. But nonetheless, this would actually now move us to a position of asserting certain things. So that's one example we need to think about the unintended consequences. Another unintended consequence is thinking through, depending on what kind of information the auditors might now be attesting to, is the question of, do we have the right skill sets necessary to do so? So, for example, if you think about MD&A, many people have thought through what elements of MD&A should be there, if it's key performance indicators, value propositions that are being discussed, or perhaps risk factors. Obviously, the unintended consequences around skill set. And another unintended consequence is to make sure that, in fact, the cost-benefit is thought through sufficiently enough to say, does this make sense for, again, the collective group of stakeholders, both when looking at it from not only an investor's eyes, but also the board's eyes, standard setters and regulators, as well as then management in and of themselves. So I think these are great proposals to start the dialogue. I'd argue I think we can go further in terms of the expectation gap, to make sure that some of these things, as well as others, are considered going forward. And those are the things that the profession and others are hopefully going to be weighing in on. And I would ask for those out there listening to this that we encourage everybody that has an interest in this, a vested interest, participate and provide that feedback, because I do believe the PCOB and the profession would benefit from that feedback that we're hoping to gain during this exercise.
Well, thanks very much, Bob, for those views. I would just note for any doctoral or graduate undergraduate students that it's a good place to look is the PCOB website, and you can look at those comment letters yourselves and try to dissect what's being said there. But I'd like to give Bob Kippers a chance to provide his perspective on any unintended adverse ripple effects. But I also would like to ask you to specifically comment on something to which Bob Moritz alluded, which is how do we think about the costs, or how should we think about the costs of providing any new auditor communications or new parts of an auditor's report? And one reason I ask is, isn't there already often little enthusiasm for increasing audit fees year over year on audit committees? And I guess another related question is, would these costs of these proposals be differentially recoverable for alternative new services, say, for example, the what Bob Moritz referred to as the ADA, auditor's discussion analysis, versus, say, an expanded use of explanatory paragraphs?
Wow. Enthusiasm for increasing fees is not I don't have a lot of depth of experience there. Let me get to that next. But first, I just want to build on what Bob Moritz was saying. A couple of things occur to me, and this is a result of working with clients for many, many years. And I'm just going to, as an example, call out a couple points. This notion of close calls. There's no question in most every set of financial statements, there's some area for a manufacturing company. It could be a warranty reserve for a bank. It might be the allowance for loan losses. They're the more difficult estimates to land on for management, and no surprise, they're one of the more time-consuming areas where we have coverage in the audit to get comfortable that the estimate is reasonable. So the notion that close calls need some special disclosure or consideration troubles me in the following sense. These are often what I'll call the most carefully analyzed, carefully discussed issues, and they actually might end up being the best decisions that are made in the process of preparing a set of financial statements. The fact that they're difficult or might fit some yet-to-be-written definition of close call sort of casts doubt on them almost out of the box. And, a report that we might generate as the auditor to some sort of free writing exercise, I think has two issues. One is it shouldn't undermine or replace our basic conclusion that the financial statements taken as a whole fairly present in accordance with GAAP. And I think everyone we've talked to said, we don't want to lose that, because that pass-fail is extremely valuable. At least our report today, you can tell if there are extra paragraphs or something non-standard. It's a little bit of I'll call it a red flag for readers of our report. But the second thing that implies is actually more interesting. A lot of the kinds of information that's being discussed now that auditors could add to their standard report are the very kinds of things that we spend a lot of time in incredibly effective and interesting dialogue with the audit committee. And it feels to me like I always use the term disintermediation, that the people who look at the financials want to sort of cut out the audit committee and go directly to the results of that process. My experience suggests that faithfully sort of capturing that dynamic in a written report may just not be possible. It's an iterative process. There's give and take. There's back and forth. We do provide reports for the audit committee's benefit on a number of areas that are set out in the standards. But the real value comes from the audit committee doing its job, questioning management, challenging the auditors when there are differences among the two in terms of an accounting treatment, sort of arbitrating the outcome to a good place. The value there is not as visible as some might want it to be, but the role is crucial, and I think that role has been strengthened certainly in the last 10 years or so with Sarbanes-Oxley, given their new duties that were set out by Congress some 10 years ago. Now, As to your question of cost, if we expand our role to include other elements of reporting or assurance or disclosure, be the sort of original source of disclosure, there's no question there will be some cost. A lot of the debate is centered around the fact, well, auditors already know a lot of these things, or that should already be in the audit working papers, therefore it's free. Anytime you do a report, there's additional quality control, there's additional review, there's going to be some element of cost. And of course, today, that's what this project is about. We do not yet have the standards, with which we would have to comply. So if there's some cost, that's the whole notion of value is the information is worth it to those that ultimately foot the bill. So if there's some cost, so be it. But I think that should be part of this debate, is the value of that information worth whatever cost. In other words, a classic cost-benefit kind of consideration.
Okay, very good. Let me shift gears here just a little bit and focus instead of on a very topical issue, which will resolve, at least start to resolve here in the next several months. And let me ask Bob Moritz the following. Whatever happens in the near term with respect to the auditor's reporting model, the investing public would benefit very clearly from deeper thought about the changing role of the auditor over the longer term. And we understand, Bob Moritz, that you're heading up an endeavor by the Center for Audit Quality, also known as the CAQ, to take a longer view and to better understand and improve the role of the public company auditor in the future. So can you tell us a little bit about what is going on with the CAQ in this regard?
Yeah, sure, Mark. Just for people's benefit, the CAQ is an organization that is a combination of representatives of the auditing profession as well as some public interest members outside of the auditing profession that really does focus and allow us to come together as a profession and say, what is it we need to do differently to enhance the quality as well as the integrity of the financial reporting process and the role that we play in it. And coming out of the financial crisis, it was clear to us that there was a number of areas of improvement across all stakeholders, including for the auditors. And the auditors today have not been viewed as causing the financial crisis. But nonetheless, the question has been raised of what could or would we do differently going forward. So as a profession under the CAQ, we came together and said two things. Number one, status quo is not an option. We as a profession should be more proactive in thinking through our evolving role and making sure it's addressing the needs of our larger stakeholder group. And second, we concluded that we did not want to put our point of view forward without first engaging and collaborating with other stakeholders. So the work stream that I'm leading, and I'm just leading it on behalf of the entire profession, and a number of representatives from the entire profession are helping with the work and doing a great job, is first off to do the convening of those stakeholder groups. So we've held a series of dinners around the country, which have brought together in groups of anywhere from 15 to 20 people, investors, regulators, standard setters, board members, audit committee members, management being CFOs, CEOs, controllers, et cetera, lawyers, and others that are participatory in this process, including representatives from outside the states that happen to be able to join us. And our questioning that we have done to date has come up with, now that we've concluded these series of dinners, the following observations. To your first question you asked earlier today, there was a consensus that there is value in the audit today. It is appreciated by all of those stakeholders. And yes, the pass-file model, while always could be better, definitely does give us a level of consistency in evaluating whether the financial statements and, in some cases, controls are acting in accordance with the standards set forth. But it is something that, in fact, is looked at regularly. The second thing that came through this was the frustration with the reporting model itself. We got into debates around the information that is being provided. We got into debates as to whether it's too much, too little, not the right information, not the right time. When you look at what I'll call the historical reliance on 10-Ks and 10-Qs, now moving away from that at times to more analyst presentations, press releases, and data bites from whatever source may be out there in a technology-driven world. But there was frustration. There was a lot of rulemaking and compliance, more so than what was believed to be the original requirements, which was the best mechanism to communicate to investors. And as a result, then the question became, what is it that a number of stakeholders could do differently? Could, for example, the preparers of financial statements do a better job in clarifying in plain English not only its financial results, but also the risk factors or the key performance indicators, et cetera, that it has a responsibility to put forth to the investing community? Could, in fact, to Bob Kipper's earlier point, the audit committee members that play a critical role in the supply chain do more in terms of disclosures to investors through perhaps its annual statements through the proxy to talk better about the kind of conversations it is having both with management, the auditors, and some of those calls that Bob Kipper's alluded to? And finally, could the auditors change what they do? And in this regard, it was well beyond what the PCAOB has put forth in its concept release, which we would view as changes to the today's auditor's report. So, for example, the question put on the table was, should you, in fact, move forward to provide some level of assurance, to be determined, around management's articulation of risk factors? And those are risk factors not necessarily just limited to financial statement risk, but rather business risk. And whether the auditor should play that role versus somebody else, as an example. Additionally, the topic of what information is provided and when, in terms of being relied on by investors, is first the question. Second, could the auditor play a different role? So, for example, as you go back, and Bob alluded to it, you know, the role of auditors has been around for many centuries. But if you do go back 80-some-odd years ago, when the 33 and 34 Act came out, it was clear that investors did rely heavily on your 10-Qs and 10-Ks. Today, some group of investors rely on that. Other groups of investors do not, and they do rely on more analyst presentations coming from the street. Maybe the day traders are relying on XYZ insight that might be across a blob. The individual investors might be reacting to press releases that go out, et cetera. And the question at the end of the day was, if there, in fact, is some kind of information that would be considered material to the investor, one, is the investor trusting that that information has the appropriate level of credibility to it and integrity? And is there a need for, again, an independent third-party source to objectively and independently assess whether that, in fact, is the case to enhance trust in the information that is being provided and ultimately relied upon in making investment decisions? So overall, as we've gone through the first phase of this process, it was to, in fact, bring together groups of people to come up with different points of view, of which, again, I would argue there were many. And the benefit of this was we did have multiple stakeholder groups around the table as opposed to a single stakeholder group, which obviously everybody comes in with their point of view. And what this did was a great job of bringing a balanced perspective and a more informed perspective to the kind of things that people are interested in and would be supportive of. So we had some good recommendations coming out. The next stage is for us to think through what are the possible list of recommended changes that, in fact, we should be thinking about. And that goes to what the auditor's role may be, but as a byproduct, are there other changes that we could give to other interested parties for other stakeholders in the supply chain? Again, for example, looking at what Bob Kipper talked earlier about from an audit committee perspective, maybe moving away from the kind of information in today's proxy statement to something that's more qualitative in nature that does get to the kind of conversations that maybe they are having in a privileged way with, not from a legal perspective, but a privileged relationship that they have between audit committee members and ultimately the auditors themselves. And our goal at the end of this next step is to come up with a series of recommendations for consideration to discuss them with one, those stakeholder groups, but two, the standard setters. And that was the other conclusion, is that it was very difficult for people to voluntarily make changes either to their financial reports, and I'll use reports there because it wasn't financial statements, but it was reporting generally, because if you went out as a first mover, would there be an implied penalty on that? And second, do we, if in fact auditors change something differently, it goes to a little bit of Bob Kipper's point earlier, will some unintended consequences be that in fact it'll be looked at negatively because it is an exception to the norm? So again, we want to be smart about what kind of proposals we put forth and recommendations we put forth, ultimately to take them maybe to a proposal stage at a later date. But the good news here is I think the profession is trying to step up its game and be more proactive and less self-serving in saying to itself, what is it we can do as a convener of those stakeholders in this financial reporting supply chain, and what is it we can propose to be done differently, well beyond perhaps what regulators today are thinking about.
Okay. Very interesting food for thought. And as I think about a lot of the things you said, Bob Moritz, and just contemplating it a little bit, it made me wonder whether auditors, if you think about the skills that auditors have today and to undertake the kinds of activities to do what they do today, do they have the kinds of skills that will help them do what they're going to be asked to do tomorrow? Bob Moritz was talking about auditor involvement in looking at management's articulation of risk factors and even business risk factors. So, and I would couple to that business modeling skills and related skills. So, Bob Kippers, is there an investment in human capital that needs to be made here?
It's a great question, and I let me just make a separate point, and then I'll do my best to answer your question. You know, I was just thinking as Bob Moritz was taking us through the CAQ efforts on role of the auditor. It's a pretty big undertaking. That he's ably leading. This program is called Role of the Auditor. The concept release on the auditor's report poses a lot of questions about activities the auditor might not be doing today, but should we consider making changes? And that's sort of a role of the auditor. And then we've got the CAQ project, which is also, you just call it the Role of the Auditor. What I'm trying to say is that the standard-setting project that's underway right now, you know, will go wherever it goes. In whatever time the PCAOB determines to conclude it. I think the distinction, though, is the CAQ's work is actually trying to take an even longer view. You know, and I don't know, that, Bob, that you've sort of picked a point in time, but, you know, the next 5-10 years, where is this going to evolve to? Where should it evolve to? How can we be the most responsive to the people that value the product we produce, and, you know, are we producing the right product? So it's very strategic in that sense. So this all gets a little bit confusing because it all sounds alike, but they're directionally the same. The mechanisms are different. On your question of do we have the skills today for what we'll have to do tomorrow, of course, the easy answer is I don't know, because I'm not sure exactly where we're going. I will tell you this, though, that as you think about some of the feedback we get from investors, particularly those that say we value the financials, but we don't use those as the foundation for an individual investment decision, we are much more attuned with, you know, press releases on new products and prospects for the company going forward, maybe press releases, you know, whatever the news is for the quarter, that might be driving more investment decisions. The truth is that the firms as organizations, particularly the larger firms, have all of these skills that can be deployed against, you know, with an audit team. I think your question, though, fundamentally says, are we, as we hire so many young people right out of school, you know, do they have the skills they need? And the answer to that is sort of, because we spend an awful lot of time training people and you know, specialties develop over time as you gain experience. I've always wondered, for example, whether the best auditor might be someone that has not only the accounting background, the auditing skills, which you can teach a little bit, but generally through experience gain, you know, was also had financial analyst credentials, had those kinds of abilities to have insight beyond, you know, whatever is sort of on the piece of paper in front of you. It is true that when we deploy a team of partners, managers, staff, you know, if you take that ladder of experience and you look at it as a total body of knowledge, not just what the individual brings to the table, we have a tremendous breadth of skills beyond what you might otherwise assume. So, you know, to me, this is a fascinating question, and You know, I often have recruited auditors from other parts of our firm and say, well, gee, this guy spent 3 years in mergers and acquisitions. He was doing financial modeling of transactions. I love to have people that are sort of non-traditional in terms of the skill set that they bring to an individual engagement team. And then the trick here is trying to match up the right people with the right clients to make sure you've got the horsepower you need to do a good job.
Well, Bob Moritz, one of the things that Bob Kippers just mentioned was on some audit teams, there is going to be some value if one or more members of that team have perhaps something akin to financial analyst credentials. And it brings up another question to me. It's a question I sometimes get as a professor. If auditors do not have all the skills that they have or will need to acquire for tomorrow's services, or even more contemporaneously, if the investing public really has very little way of knowing which auditors do possess these skills and which do not, start thinking about the implications. And, of course, I think about implications for college curricula, but sometimes I get questions about why is it, for example, that CPAs, accountants, stop with that basic credentialing, whereas medical doctors, for example, often will go on to be credentialed further. For example, by the American Board of Orthopedic Surgery, and even within that, some subspecialty credentialing sometimes occurs, as with hand surgery. Or maybe your perspective is that this can all be addressed through careful, ongoing professional training. So I guess my question is, how do investors know more about the specific capabilities of particular auditors?
Yeah. Mark, it's a great question. I guess to first follow up with Bob Kipper's comments. Where we go with all of this, I think, is obviously up for debate, but we do want to make sure it's a thorough debate and not just assume that it's going to, you know, this place or that place over various periods of time. So, you know, this will evolve over time, which goes back to then, are we evolving the relevant skill sets of the people that A, are in college and universities today, and B, in our firms, to be able to exercise and bring that relevant auditing, accounting, and industry experience and functional experience to be able to do the job. I guess I have a couple reactions. First and foremost, you know, at the end of the day, we are now a regulated business. So we do have a regulator in the PCAOB that is doing a few things, not only its individual examinations of audits, but also taking a look at, you know, the overarching control systems in the firms to make sure that they are doing all they need to do to ensure a quality audit. That includes taking a look at, you know, what kind of people are you recruiting, what kind of training goes on, are you actually bringing to them the right relevant experiences as well as training necessary to do your job, again, to understand the different skills and needs that are existing today. And to Bob Kipper's point, it is a combination of what gets done in the classroom. It is a combination of then what gets done on the job. And also, let's keep in mind, it's consistent with what I'll call the supervisory responsibilities of our leadership teams to make sure that those experiences and knowledges are shared collectively within firms and, for that matter, across the profession when it matters most. To make sure that we're doing all we can to ensure ultimately that ultimate obligation and mission statement. So as I look forward, there is a question of whether or not you need additional credentialing. Now, keep in mind, many of our people do have that additional credentialing. You talk about tax professionals, there's certain credentials they have. When you look about and listen to some of our IT people, with IT becoming a bigger and more important part of the audit, clearly we rely on those specialists and the credentialing that goes on from them as well. So I think as we look forward and look ahead to the evolving role of auditor and think through what is it that's needed today, regardless of extending the role of the auditor, that's changed over time. Number two, as we extend that perhaps to different places, what are the needs and the skill sets, and how do the colleges as well as we make sure that we bring together the right education, experience, and exposure so people are best positioned to serve the ultimate need. And then finally, the combination of the regulatory environment by which we operate as well as the competitive environment by which we operate is actually still a good governing mechanism to make sure we have the right skill sets, which, again, I'll go back to, for example, when we propose on new pieces of work. And I literally was at one yesterday where, you know, an audit committee was specifically asking our firm, tell me more about the experiences and people you have in XYZ area. That, again, is another governance mechanism when you look to the role of the audit committee, saying that they're responsible for the hiring and or dismissal of individual auditors, and then one of their responsibilities is to look at the qualification of the firms going on today. So I think it's work in progress, but I do think there's some natural governance mechanisms regardless of enhancements of the certifications. And to the extent there is a need for additional certification or enhancements or leveling of certifications, I think the market demands will create that, and we'll see the adjustments both in what gets done at the academical level as well as the firm level, and then also with the standard setters and the credentialing organizations that we have here in the country, not only here in the U.S., but obviously as you think about that question, it's a much broader question globally as well. And Bob and I, for this thus part today, have been talking about the U.S. This similar issue has equal implications to how CPAs or the equivalents are thought about around the world as they continue to do the same. And eventually we'll talk about something called worldwide standards and obligations as well, but that's yet to come.
Well, okay. I think that Bob Kippers may want to jump in here with
a follow-up comment, because I couldn't say it better than Bob Moritz, but I was thinking as he was speaking about one thing that we don't talk about all the time, but the tremendous value of industry expertise is a good example. So I've got a partner named Charlie, and Charlie has been doing audits of essentially investor-owned electric utilities for almost his whole career. That one individual has seen more than any training I could ever give him, and he's got his, you know, he's got CPA after his name, but I couldn't even come up with a credential that would capture the value of that experience. And it's important to realize that the client, the audit committee, will often ask about our expertise, but they aren't expecting that lead partner is going to have every element that's needed, but they are expecting that lead partner can tap into those resources. So, you know, everything from certified fraud examiners, of whom we have many on staff, to not only a tax specialist, but somebody that understands with depth a certain weird kind of tax credit that's at issue at this company. That's the level it has to get down to. So I think it's very hard, Mark, to step back and say, here's the answer. Here's the credential we all need. I think it's more of a portfolio approach of, you know, and if we don't have it in the firm, we would actually go out and get it for an individual need. So I think it's a complicated but fascinating question as we get this role of the auditor work to its logical conclusion, whatever that is. I think it's part of the whole series of questions that we're trying to answer.
Well, let me thank you, Bob Kippers, for that. And together those answers obviously have a lot of harmony. Good food for thought. I want to actually go back to your string quartet for a moment,
okay,
because I think that as students develop their understanding of the environment in which auditing takes place, probably one of the least understood roles is that of the audit committee. And it's easy for me to see how, for example, management is held accountable by good auditors, and how an auditor is now held accountable by what Bob Moritz was saying. It's a regulated profession by inspections and other means, and yes, by the threat of legal liability. How is it that audit committee members are held accountable for dispatching their fiduciary duty to protect shareholders? I mean, unlike auditors, aren't audit committee members given a bit of a safe harbor under the business judgment rule?
I can pretty much guess that the audit committee members themselves might not agree with you. I mean, the business judgment rule is interesting, but the point is that all audit committee members are board members first. They have fiduciary duties not only because of their board membership as you know, full-fledged independent members of the board, but they have additional responsibility because of the charter of their audit committee. I mean, ultimately, and I'm not a lawyer, so I can't play that speculation game, but I will tell you that the charter of the audit committee is something that audit committees I'm familiar with spend an awful lot of time on. And while there may be minor changes from year to year, it's constantly under discussion and review. I think if we've fallen down anywhere in our system, I think it's less about accountability, because I think audit committee members are accountable at the end of the day. We've seen some of that in some of the failures that have been so high profile in the last 10 years. You know, most of them are pretty old. There hasn't been a lot lately. But I will tell you that it's a shame that the public doesn't understand with sufficient clarity and depth the importance of how the audit committee actually works. I was kidding around on this topic saying, you know, some investors have said, we'd like to know more about what goes on inside that audit committee room. And my flippant response is, well, let's just put the meetings on YouTube. The problem with that is that so much of what is discussed in that audit committee room and in an executive session is by design not a public activity, but extremely important and, in my experience, very effective. So one of the ways to sort of, you know, unveil the mystery here is to really think about a better way, and there are a lot of people who wouldn't agree with this, but for audit committees to report their activities. Bob Moritz just said, you know, it's in the proxy. Well, it's in the proxy because as board members, board of directors, members of the board, shareholders have to vote for their election. So you put it in the proxy because it's more information. Why wouldn't it make more sense to put that in the 10-K right alongside management's report, the outside auditor's report, the report on internal controls? Because, you know, this is like going to a concert where only three members of the string quartet are listed in the program. It doesn't make any sense to me. And I'll argue another day whether they're the cello or the viola or whatever. I just know that the audit committee is not the second violin, all right? But I'm telling you that there's so much good that's done, and where we've not done a great job as a system is giving people the insight as to the activities of the audit committee. But that could be solved with a more responsive kind of reporting regime.
I think, Mark, maybe before we jump into the next question, just to follow up on Bob's point here, I think there is clearly, as Bob said, you know, a lack of transparency of what gets discussed in that board. But again, for good reason, because, again, if anything were to be listened to and taken out of context, very similar to what we talked about with a matter of emphasis and an audit opinion, it really does perhaps lose the relevancy of the comment and, in fact, take away the responsibility of the audit committee management to then deal with that comment, and without, you know, candidly implicating in any way, shape, or form the investor itself for the lack of knowledge around that. But I will say that we need to be smart around this role of the audit committee because, again, it is not a role of management. It is a role of governance, and there are certain fiduciary responsibilities that they have that are outlined. Some of them were outlined further in SOX when Section 404 came out in terms of its obligations for its interaction around the financial reporting model and the auditor's role specifically within that. So, again, as people think about these different roles, that's why we want to make sure we bring together lots of points of view before going through and changing anything to make sure that we're really addressing some root cause issues as opposed to just a surface-level issue, which at the end of the day, it's around our meeting expectations, and we've got to make sure that we're clear in terms of how do we meet most of the expectations, but maybe not those that are just screaming the loudest around this topic.
Okay, Bob Moritz, let me stick with you here and ask you a question. Suppose you had the capability to talk to some students who are thinking about going into the profession, and they were wondering, what rewards do auditors get if they do a particularly sound job at the audit? Or what rewards even does management get for, you know, somehow going beyond the mere compliance mentality? Students might see, for example, that auditors are expressly disallowed from whistleblower money while others are eligible for it, according to the relatively new Dodd-Frank provisions. And one that is difficult for me to explain, when an auditor takes a stand and walks away from a fee-generating client because of questions perhaps about internal controls or financial reporting, there is really no direct pecuniary reward. And as far as I know, audit firm compensation systems do not explicitly reward auditors who unearth material misstatements or help engineer walking away from clients, or do they?
Yeah, a great question. I guess let me deal with from a student's perspective first, which is, at the end of the day, the reward for being in this profession and doing the right thing is a combination of the experience and exposure that's going to make them a better individual later if they decide to stay within the profession or move on to do something else. Because, again, it's all around the experience that these individuals get. And I think each of the firms across the entire profession goes to this value of making sure that we've got individuals with the highest level of integrity that can look themselves in the mirror and feel good about what they did today, what impact that had, that ultimately, in fact, was valued by the investor and other stakeholders. And that's the reward that you get, separate and distinct from compensation, benefits, and everything else. I do want to take on your last point, though, Mark, which is, and I'm speaking with general knowledge, not specific knowledge about, you know, the rest of the firms, and Bob Kippers can add this as well, but I do know that each of the firms has a reward system. So, for example, for their partners, that there absolutely is enhanced rewards for demonstrating the right behaviors around quality, dealing with and finding issues, managing them in the right way, spending the time, energy, and working teams collectively to get to better answers. And yes, in some cases, when we walk away from clients, they absolutely are rewarded in the processes that we have in place today. And I can speak on behalf of my own firm explicitly around that, because we just finished our compensation process. And I know in talking to my counterparts, and Bob can add on to this as well, that they've got, you know, similar mechanisms as we think about it, because there's clearly risks and rewards. Similarly, when people don't do a good job, miss things, did not handle the matter correctly, et cetera, that there is a risk to their compensation. In fact, depending on the severity, a fairly big risk. So I do want to come back to that, because there is this perception that in our compensation systems we don't reward that, but that's the farthest from the truth. And I think each of the firms has continued to evolve that over the last number of years as we look ahead.
Well, let me jump in, and I am not going to give this a due time, but there is an elephant in the room issue that we should probably bring up in real short time here, Bob Kippers. Maybe your response in about a minute. An age-old issue of mandatory auditor rotation. How can that, or can it, improve the financial reporting supply chain?
Well, I don't know that that's an age-old issue, but it is a current issue. I'll give you that. I think the real age-old issue is the sufficiency of independence, objectivity, and professional skepticism. Anything that could improve that is good for the profession. The question on the table is mandatory rotation a mechanism by which you could improve those elements? Not to be silly, but take it to an extreme, you could change your audit firm every year. You'd be as objective as could be, but you absolutely would have no idea what's going on. On the other end, you know, should a firm be auditor for 100 years for a company? I mean, it's these long-term tenured relationships that tend to get attention. I just think we have to be really careful about the problem we are trying to solve and potential unintended consequences of having sort of an easy answer to a very complex problem. So my hope is that our regulator and standard setter, the PCAOB, will look at this issue with care and depth before rushing to judgment on anything.
And ready before we wrap up on that, Bob exactly has hit what I'll call the unintended consequences issue, so we need to be smart about this. But I do want to put a little bit of a back test to this issue, which is, if you look at the financial crisis, and some will argue, again, what could the others have done differently, none of that relates to, in my judgment, the issue around mandatory rotation and what that would solve for. It absolutely does in terms of the relevancy of what we do and what we report on. So, again, we want to be very clear in terms of what's the problem you're trying to solve for, what are the options to solve that problem and the pros and cons, and let's make sure we come up with the right answer without having to expose ourselves to additional concerns or maybe even a detriment around quality and the unintended consequences that may come from it.
Well said.
Okay, Bob, is there any parting, Bob Kippers, any parting words you would like to share with students about any tangible and intangible words? I know Bob Morentz has talked about that, that tomorrow's auditing professional should be thinking about before investing their human capital in the auditing profession.
I've said this before, perhaps, but I believe it to this day, and that is that auditing public companies is a very high calling indeed. Probably the most memorable days of my life have been the tough days where we have walked away from a client in a bad situation, and the professional pride of doing the right thing is more psychic income than I can explain. Those are defining moments in one's career, and I just love what I do.
Well, Bob, thank you for this informative discussion. Today's program will be an important addition to the collection of materials on education, auditing, and accounting in the museum collection. The audio of today's broadcast is now available on www.sechistorical.org, and an edited transcript will be prepared soon. I invite you to return on Tuesday, October 18th, for the next Deloitte Fireside Chat, looking at the SEC role in accounting standard setting. Professor Mark Beasley of North Carolina State University will be the moderator. The presenters will be Loretta Cangelosi of Pfizer, Bob Kippers, and Arthur Wyatt, one of my colleagues at Illinois, a retired partner at Arthur Anderson & Co., and a former professor at the University of Illinois. The live broadcast will take place at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, free and accessible worldwide without prior registration. You're welcome to send in questions for that discussion to the museum by October 17th. On behalf of the SEC Historical Society, I would like to thank Deloitte LLP for its generous support and assistance in making today's program possible. Thank you for joining with us today. Good afternoon.